Harvard celebrated its 360th commencement this year, and in it walked a member of the Wampanoag Indians of Martha's Vineyard. She is the second member of her tribe to receive an undergraduate degree from Harvard. And when was the first?
Yeah, I was thinking 1965.
Nope.
And then I realized that he had, in fact, graduated in 1665.
That's right. Not 1965. 1665. 346 years ago. His name was Caleb Chaisha-Tehamook, and he's the subject of Geraldine Brooks' new novel, Caleb's Crossing. In May, we spoke to the Pulitzer Prize-winning writer who, not so long ago, made Martha's Vineyard her permanent home.
And I was fascinated by suddenly having Native American neighbors, and I wanted to learn more about their history and culture. I had all this material that I'd scrounged up from the tribe, and one of the items was a map of the island showing sites of significance. And right near where we were then living was a notation saying it was the birthplace of Caleb, the first Native American graduate of Harvard. And I thought, cool, maybe I'll see him at the farmer's market. And then I realized that he had, in fact, graduated in 1665.
1665.
Yeah, I was thinking 1965.
No chance to see him at the market
at all. I'm afraid not.
This is a remarkable story. I mean, the fact that not long after the founding of, I guess, what was then Harvard College, they had a Native American graduate.
They had a number of students. In fact, in the Harvard Charter, the mission of Harvard is stated to be the education of English and Indian youth of the country in knowledge and godliness.
But you don't tell the story of Caleb through his eyes in your new book, Caleb's Crossing. You actually choose to tell the story through someone else's eyes entirely. And who is that?
She is the young daughter of one of the English families who've come to live on the island in 1641. About 20 families settled on a small piece of land in what's now Edgartown. And she's entirely invented, but she's the daughter of the minister. And she's an intellectually curious, interested in learning more about her own island and also the education that's denied to her as a Puritan girl.
And her name is Bethia?
Yes.
That's the narrator in Geraldine Brooks' new book, Caleb's Crossing. I'm wondering, Geraldine, if you could read us a section from the book. And this is where Bethia actually introduces herself to Caleb.
As for my name, he found it equally peculiar once I told him that Bethia meant servant. He said a servant was but a lowly thing, their servants being more like serfs, enemies captured in battle, who may be harassed and despised, even sometimes tortured when the enmity between tribes is most bitter. I, as granddaughter of the coatman's Song Kem and daughter of their powwow, should have a higher name, as he thought. I tried to explain that my father was no powwow, but I did not yet have subtlety enough in his tongue to convey the very great difference between mediating God's grace and holding familiarity with Satan. I did struggle to make clear to him the nature and virtue of being a servant of God, but he would have none of it and grew impatient. He set off down the beach with his long, loping stride, and I had to run to keep pace with him. Of a sudden, he turned to me and announced that he had decided to name me over in the Indian manner. He said he would call me Storm Eyes, since my eyes were the color of a thunderhead. Well and good, said I, but I will rename you also, because to me you are not hateful. I told him I would call him Caleb, after the companion of Moses in the wilderness, who was noted for his powers of observation and his fearlessness.
That's Geraldine Brooks reading from her new book, Caleb's Crossing. Geraldine, your writing is noted for the exemplary amount of research that you do to really get into the mind and, of course, the culture of the time period that you're writing about. You know, one would think that with the amount of documentation there is about early American history, that writing about 17th century Massachusetts and Harvard would be an easy thing to do. But I understand it wasn't that simple, because for Caleb himself, there's only one piece of actual historical documentation that survives.
There's a beautiful letter that he wrote to his benefactors in England who had funded his education. And it's in Latin and magnificently written. His calligraphy was impeccable. and it discusses the myth of Orpheus. But since the book came out, I've
Orpheus
actually...
who went between worlds.
Yes, yes, and as it, how it relates to his situation. The trouble is the 17th century was a really precarious time for everybody, and we just don't have a huge paper trail. For example, there were no women's journals before 1700 in colonial America.
I was going to ask you about that because you've written this book in the voice of a young woman.
It created some difficulty, and there are no really what we would recognize as diaries till 1750, which is a whole 100 years later. So to get the voice for Bethia, I needed to look in other places. So I looked in the courts and the religious interrogations, which would all be taken careful note of and often include verbatim testimony, so you can hear women's voices there.
And what did you hear in those voices?
You know, I think we 21st century feminists think we're the only ones who ever had this bright idea that maybe the deck was stacked against women. Actually, if you read 17th century women speaking, you'll find that even in a harsh dispensation like Puritan New England, women knew very well that they had a bum deal. So that was quite inspiring to me in thinking how to develop my character.
Through your research and your writing of this novel, you've sort of filled in the blanks, at least fictionally, of the story of Caleb. Do we know what actually happened to him in reality?
We do, and I'm going to make you read the book to find out. Okay. But I will say this much. He was being groomed by Thomas Danforth, who was a considerable figure among the elite of the colony. He was a deputy governor and a famous jurist who presided over the Salem witch trials later. And he obviously identified Caleb as a remarkable intellect. And so I think that we can assume that Caleb was destined for some very great things, and unfortunately, fate intervened. If Caleb and his fellow scholar, Joel Iacumus, who, like him, was a Vineyard Wampanoag, and like him, completed the very exacting and rigorous course of study at Harvard, if they had lived, maybe history would have gone a different way. Things were still quite possible in 1665 that became impossible just 5 years later.
You know, Geraldine Brooks, in speaking with you and just listening to the way that even now in our conversation, I can see your mind is still sort of inhabiting that world that you research, the 17th century world of Puritans and Harvard and Massachusetts. One might think that, yes, that is the province of novelists. That's what novelists do. They pour their souls into discovering places, fictional or real, in the course of their research for their book. But many people may know that before you became a novelist, you were actually a foreign correspondent for the Wall Street Journal.
That's right, for many years, yeah.
And so I wonder, your training in that case is to see the details, to try and understand the people and the ways of being in cultures that are foreign. Is novel writing very much the same thing? It is a type of foreign correspondence, especially when you're trying to understand a world that's 300 or 400 years gone?
It is and it isn't. You know, the difference is that when you're a journalist, if you can't nail it down, if you can't find the document or get the interview and know the thing unequivocally, you can't write it. So the opposite is true with historical fiction. You follow the line of fact as far as you can, and I really do try to follow it as far as I can because I do think truth is the best storyteller of all. But then when the historical voices fall silent or the record has a big gap in it, You suit up and you take the swan dive into the world of what I think of as an informed imaginative empathy, where you try and put yourself in shoes that are very different in make and color and size and shape to your own.
Geraldine Brooks, this is such a remarkable story that in 1665, a young man named Caleb, a Wampanoag Indian, attended Harvard University. Except for the fact that hundreds of years, if I understand it correctly, have passed since another member of the tribe actually went to Harvard.
There have been other tribe members who've received graduate degrees, but this year, in fact, will be the first Vineyard Wampanoag to graduate from Harvard College, a 4-year BA degree since Caleb, and that young lady is named Tiffany Smalley. And it's a very exciting time, not only for the Wampanoag, but for everybody on the vineyard to celebrate that. And an added celebration is that Harvard is using the occasion of Tiffany's commencement to award a posthumous degree to Joel Iacumus, who was killed before he could march in the commencement ceremony in 1665. So all these years later, he will finally get the degree that he earned.
Well, Geraldine Brooks, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Oh, it's been a pleasure.
Geraldine Brooks' new novel is Caleb's Crossing. There's an excerpt of the book at our website, radioboston.org.
That's our interview with Geraldine Brooks from May. Coming up, for decades, federal judge Nancy Gertner has been an unrepentant advocate for women, but she says there's still a long way to go.
The economy has contracted the legal employment force, and it appears that the people leaving first are women.
Stay with us. I'm Adam Ragusea.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.